It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. If you're a Los Angeles Laker fan that I am, you're very aware of the different eras of Laker greatness. Going back to the early years after the arrival in Los Angeles with Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, Wilt Chamberlain's later arrival, a championship for that group of Lakers. And then, of course, Showtime, the era of the 1980s where you had the Lakers led by Magic Johnson, James Worthy, Pat Riley, the coach, and glamour was such a part of the team. And then, of course, in the late 90s into the early aughts, you had Kobe Bryant, Shaquille O'Neal, Phil Jackson combining. Later on, after Shaq is traded to the Miami Heat, Pau Gasol arrives and the Lakers pick up their winning ways again. And now, of course, this latest version of the Lakers, Wednesday night, begins the NBA Championship Series against the Miami Heat. And we'll see if LeBron James, Anthony Davis, and crew are able to bring another championship to Los Angeles. Jeff Perlman wrote a wonderful book about that Showtime era of the Lakers. Came out 6 years ago. And he's now followed it up with Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the crazy years of the Lakers dynasty. Jeff Perlman, for many years, a writer for Sports Illustrated and author of numerous books. Jeff, great to have you with us again. We appreciate it.
I heard the Lakers are doing pretty well this year.
They're doing all right. Yeah, this era's working out okay. Nothing like Anthony Davis, right? So you now live in Southern California. When you wrote Showtime, you weren't living here. And I wonder, has anything changed in your view of the team by being here?
I think so. I actually think the one thing that really hit me the most, and I think if I were living in New York, I would not have, was when Kobe sadly passed earlier this year, just the insanely large impact and impression he left on people. And I mean, I grew up in New York during the Patrick Ewing era, and people loved Ewing, but it just wasn't the same. And I felt by living here, I could really feel a wallop and just the heartache and the just how much it carved out of people, his loss and what he meant to L.A.
Well, and you, of course, after writing this book, you spent a couple years on it, and then we had Kobe's tragic death early this year. How did that hit you, given that you had talked with, you know, hundreds of people about Kobe Bryant?
It was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. I was sitting in a coffee shop, and a writer named Amy Bass sent me a text, and it said, reports Kobe dead. And that doesn't make any sense. And I've written books, obviously, about people who have passed before. I wrote Walter Payton's biography. But there's something about spending 2 years devoting yourself to a subject and then having that person die in between the completion of the research and the book come out. It was honestly, truly, truly as devastating as news that I've probably ever heard, just in the moment.
Also, there is such the distinct contrast between the affection that you were just describing we Southern Californians have for Kobe and the perception of his teammates, very negative views of him and people that competed against him. And all of this that's delineated in Three Ring Circus. What did that sort of present to you as a challenge, telling this story in which Kobe Bryant is, there's certainly some empathy, but comes across, if not villainous, as a pretty nasty person?
Yeah, it's in a way the challenge comes in the aftermath. When I was reporting the book, you know, when you're writing about someone and he's alive and also he's changed, he's not the person he was, it's sort of spoken with a, well, you know, here's who he was, and I'll tell you all about who he was. But just to be clear, he's not that guy now. And that there was always an understanding of that when you're talking about history. But when you're then talking about someone who has recently passed and you're telling those same stories and people ask you, well, tell me about Evo Colorado or tell me about the fight he got in with Samaki Walker, stuff like that, it just carries a weight to it that I wasn't really thinking about or couldn't have been thinking about when I worked on the book. if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. Well, and it also, I think, raises the complexity for those of us that are fans who are so in awe of the talents of people that, and not just sports, that perform at a very high level. I was reading about Stan Kenton, the great big band leader and composer, and came across a contention from his daughter that was absolutely despicable and troubling. And it raises again this issue of how do you, as a fan of someone, deal with something that's revealed that's just, you know, awful about the person. And there's no good answer for that, but I think it's something, Jeff, that many of us sort of we struggle with.
I remember being a kid. This always enters my head. There was a TV show called Growing Pains in the 1980s. And there was one episode where a kid named Ben Seaver, he wins a contest to see his favorite singer, and he gets to meet him behind the scenes. I don't know why I remember this. I always remember this. And Alan Thicke is the dad, and they take him to meet the singer before the show. And the singer is, the kid catches him making out with a woman who's not his wife. And the kid is just devastated. And the whole show is about how do you handle this? And what Jason Seaver told Ben at the end was that you can enjoy a person's performance and you can enjoy what they put out into the universe, whether it's sports or cooking or whatever, music, and not feel everything about them. And I think Kobe Bryant went through a lot of really difficult periods in his life where he was hard to like. He was a difficult teammate. He was a difficult person for Phil Jackson to coach. He wanted to be the king of it all. He did. That's just undeniable. He wanted to be the king of it all. But he also worked his butt off. And how many people say at an early age, I want to be Michael Jordan, and then become Michael Jordan? You know, like so I think when he passed and there was criticism. How can we overlook Eagle Colorado? How can we overlook the way he treated people? I think for a lot of people, what it came down to was here was a man who set out dreams, set out goals, worked as hard as anyone we'd ever seen to accomplish them, did accomplish them, and also, not for nothing, had this sort of second act in life where he was a dad of four and a husband and an Academy Award winner and a youth coach. And I think it is okay to remember people that way and not have to remember it. You know, if you want to remember someone just for number 8 on the Lakers or 24 in the Lakers, I think that's totally fine.
Well, and the other thing is, Jeff, and you write about this also, the tremendous challenge that Kobe had in fitting in anywhere. He truly was a fish out of water. And you detail what, you know, many of us know about him, the growing up in Italy as his dad's a professional basketball player there. And, you know, he doesn't really fit in there. He comes back to the U.S. for high school in Pennsylvania and doesn't really fit in there. And he comes to the NBA with a lot of guys who coming from, you know, experiences growing up in very challenging home environments and in communities that have great challenges. He never fits in, and that some of what is his mean behavior or belittling or not even recognizing people, giving them the time of day, that some of this would undoubtedly be part of his own insecurities and feeling of not belonging.
I really think one thing we do, almost everyone, when it comes to meeting famous people, is we just make this assumption that they're really cool and really secure. And you look at Kobe Bryant, age whatever, 20. He's a good-looking guy, and he's wearing the purple and gold, and he's very famous, and he has a sneaker deal and a soda deal, and wow. And the truth of the matter is, for Kobe Bryant and for a lot of these guys, you're kind of brought in up in a bubble. Kobe was raised, as you noted, he was raised largely in Italy. He was the only black face around. He was kind of, you know, in a way Kareem Abdul-Jabbar used to have with being really tall in New York back in the day, he was kind of a curiosity for a lot of people. The little kid with the afro in Italy who's really good at basketball. Then he moves back to Pennsylvania, and he doesn't move to Philly. Everyone says he's from Philly. He's not from Philly. He's from Lower Merion, which is leafy and Mercedes and BMWs. And again, he's one of the few African-American kids. He takes Brandy, the singer, to his prom on an arranged date. He has a shoe deal by the time he's 17. There was never a time for him to really develop certain social skills that would have done him well later. And when he shows up in the NBA in his first team meeting, when everyone's introducing themselves in Hawaii and they're going around saying, hey, I'm Nick Van Exel. Hey, I'm Shaq. He says, hey, I'm Kobe. I'm from Lower Merion, and nobody here is going to punk me. Now, that's That's a just turned 18-year-old kid misreading a room as bad as you possibly can. And he had a lot of, because of where he came from and his upbringing and sort of the abnormalities of it all, he read a lot of rooms wrongly.
We're talking with journalist Jeff Perlman, a longtime Sports Illustrated writer, author of numerous books, including a terrific look at the Lakers' Showtime era. His new book, Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. One of the things I didn't realize until reading Jeff's book was how the bad blood between Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal was there almost from the very beginning. In incidents just like what Jeff described, that this was not just something that friction over time between two gifted athletes then rears its head. We'll talk more about those Lakers. And, you know, one of the important stars of this who's not in the title of the book is Jerry Buss, the owner of the team, whose presence is huge, not just regarding the eccentric Dennis Rodman, but in other ways, too. We'll talk with Jeff Perlman, author of Three Ring Circus. We continue in 90 seconds on Air Talk. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with Jeff Perlman. His new book, Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. If you have questions for him about those years when the Lakers were winning a fair amount of the time, even as there was drama on an almost daily basis, we're at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Jeff, set the stage for this team coming together. You've got, you know, Magic Johnson has retired because of testing HIV positive. The Showtime era comes apart. Pat Riley departs. And so what is Jerry Buss and team president Jerry West's ideas for rejuvenating the organization on the court?
Well, they need a reboot in a major way. They have a coach, Dale Harris, who they're okay with. Magic comes back. It's a complete disaster. It just doesn't go well. And they're entering the draft with a low pick. But they know two things. Well, they know, number one, that Shaquille O'Neal is about to be a free agent, and the guy's made for L.A., and that his agent, Leonard Amato, definitely desperately wants him in L.A. and has wanted him in L.A. for years. And they end up working out this kid out of Lower Merion High School named Kobe Bryant. And they don't know much about him. They don't know if they're going to get him, but they hear pretty good things. So they bring him in for a workout. And Jerry West is there, and it's otherworldly. And Jerry West walks away and says, that's the best workout I've ever seen a young guy do. Brings him back one more time to work out with Michael Cooper, who was an assistant coach at that point. Michael Cooper used to be a really great defensive player in the NBA, and Kobe just lights him up. Now, the problem is the Kobe edition story is one of my favorites, because the problem is the Lakers don't have a draft pick. Like, yeah. They don't have a pick to get them. They have a late pick. So the New Jersey Nets have the number 8 pick in the draft. And John Calipari is their new coach, now the famous John Calipari. But at the time, just coming off of UMass, and he gets his big deal. John Calipari is the coach of the Nets. They work out Kobe Bryant 4 or 5 times because he doesn't live that far away. And they absolutely love him. And John Nash, the general manager of the Nets, is convinced, this is what we're going to do. We are drafting Kobe Bryant. If he's there at number 8, we're taking Kobe. And they call Kobe's parents, Pam and Joe Bryant, and they say, we're going to take your son. Are you comfortable with that? Okay, great. Let's do it. We're in. So Adidas, Kobe has a deal with Adidas, and Adidas does not like this. They want him in L.A. They want him in a big market. New Jersey is not a big market, despite what people think. So Kobe Bryant one day calls John Calipari. I think it's 2 days before the draft, and says, hey, coach, it's Kobe. I've been thinking about it, and I think I want to get away from my parents. So I prefer you don't draft me. John Calipari's freaking out. And he goes to John Nash, the general manager. He says, John, what am I going to do? John Nash is like, listen, Cal, it's all bluffing. Don't worry about it. It's all bluffing. All right. Kobe's agent calls Calipari and says, listen, if you guys draft Kobe, he's probably going to skip the NBA for a year. He'll probably go play in Italy for a year. Calipari now, his hair is on fire. He runs into the GM's office. John, I don't know what we're going to do. They're blah, blah, blah. This is, we can't draft Kobe Bryant. And John Nash, seasoned GM, is like, Cal, they're bluffing. Don't worry about it. Meanwhile, Kerry Kittles is coming out of Villanova, and he's represented by David Falk. And David Falk calls John Calipari and says, Cal, my client really wants the Nets to draft him. If you don't pick Kerry Kittles, if he's there at number eight, I can't promise you I'll ever bring any free agents your way.
Which is a huge amount of talent that Falk represented.
Also ludicrous. Obviously, you're not taking a team off the table. Calipari goes running up to Nat. John, what are we doing? We cannot draft Kobe Bryant. John asks just over and over again, listen, Cal, all's good. It's all good. You're okay. The draft day comes. Calipari gathers everyone around. Now, a big thing to know here is John Calipari, in his contract, had final personnel say. So even though John Nash was the GM, Calipari had final say. They all get together. John Nash knows we're drafting Kobe Bryant. This is going to be great. And Calipari says, guys, here's the deal. If Kerry Kittles is available at number eight, we're taking Kerry Kittles. And if he's not, we're going Kobe Bryant. And John Nash basically cries in his soup. And the draft comes. Of course, Kerry Kittles of Villanova is there at number eight. Jerry West knows how the draft is going to be laid out. He knows the four teams afterwards are not going after a high school guard. He's in LA just pumping his fist. And as soon as they get Charlotte drafts Kobe Bryant, they trade the rights to Kobe to the Lakers for Vlade Divac, a very good center. And as soon as this all goes down, Jerry West goes into Jerry Buss' office and says, I just got you the best player in this draft. And that's how Kobe Bryant got to the Lakers.
We're talking with Jeff Perlman, three-ring circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the crazy years of the Lakers dynasty. Don't you quote Kerry Kittles in the book as saying, well, I would have drafted Kobe above me?
I called Kerry Kittles. And yeah, he was like, look, I played with Kobe in a little bit of something. I would have drafted him too. The guy was just phenomenal. So even Kerry Kittle is willing to admit Kobe Bryant was a better player than Kerry Kittles.
I love all the people that you talk with that are not household name players from there, who opened up so much about the experiences. And, one of whom you even tracked down, who'd been kind of off the public radar and showed up at his front door, wondering whether you were going to get smacked down for doing it. But, share with us how you identified some of these role players as such great sources for you.
Well, it's not like you. Well, the one you referenced was J.R. Ryder, who was only there in 2000, 2001. And I didn't have a phone number, only an address. So I told my wife, hold the dog, Poppy. I'm going to drive to find J.R. Ryder and let's see what happens. And I get to Arizona and J.R. Ryder has no idea I'm coming. And I knock on the door. And when he finally comes to the door, he's not happy, like not happy at all. And he's like, bro, what are you doing here? Bro, that is not cool. And he comes out and I honestly think he's going to punch me. And he's like, so what are you writing about? And I'm like, well, I'm doing a book about the Lakers, Shaq, Kobe era. He's like, all right, man, I'll talk to you. And he gave me 2 hours of great, like pure great. And the thing is, it's not like I say, all right, I need to find these five guys. My approach to sort of writing these books and researching is just call everyone. So if I can get Mike Penberthy on the phone, who was there for a spell, I get him. Mark Madsen was great. Jimmy King, former Michigan Fab Fiver, was in Kobe's first summer league team. So you call them. It's just a matter of spreading as wide a net as possible. My general philosophy is this. I wrote Brett Favre's biography years ago. And somewhere in Green Bay in like 1997, there was a free agent running back from Bucknell who lasted 2 weeks in Packers camp. Brett Favre isn't going to remember that guy. But that guy's going to remember every story he has about Brett Favre.
So true.
Yep. So that's kind of how I go about it.
Yeah.
That's how I go about it.
And then, of course, there are the big names. The time you spend interviewing Shaq for this at Turner Studios in Atlanta, a full day in Montana with Phil Jackson, who's a wonderful conversationalist, and we've had as a guest on this program a number of times, and just very interesting guy to talk with. So you had people being very candid about this. Everything from actual physical altercations during practice to emotional breakdowns by members of the team, problems with addiction. It's all there in the very dramatic circumstances of the Kobe, Shaq, Phil, crazy years of the Lakers dynasty. And Jeff Perlman's book, Three Ring Circus. If you have questions for him about this era of the Lakers, we're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute. If you were not a lover of Shaquille O'Neal before reading Three Ring Circus Jeff Perlman's new book, you certainly would be by the end of it. Shaq comes off as one of the most generous, gracious, funny, encouraging teammates players could possibly have. And not just with big names, but someone who would concern himself with the 12th member of the Laker roster and who just really reached out to people. But clearly, Jeff Perlman, one of the big problems between Kobe and Shaq that you detail was that Kobe Bryant didn't feel the love for Shaq, didn't really give him his due as one of the greatest players of all time, and didn't respond to the entreaties that Shaq made to him, entreaties of friendship.
It's really fascinating, actually, because a lot of people, I think J.A. Adande, who covered the team for the LA Times, first told me this. He's like, you would think from looking at it from afar that Kobe would be the young, insecure guy, and Shaq, you know, size, strength, salary, would be this secure sort of rock. And in a way, it was the opposite. Like, Kobe didn't care if you loved him. Like, he really showed no interest in the love of teammates. And I don't say that meanly, but when he got married in Dana Point to Vanessa, none of his teammates were invited. I'm not sure any of them actually knew the wedding was taking place. And a good number of them had no idea he was having a girl. He had a girlfriend. Shaq, on the other hand, it was just a party. It was always a party. And who wants to go out to dinner? And who can we do this? And, you know, I mentioned Mike Penberthy of Masters College makes the Lakers. And he only has one jacket and he's wearing it. And he bought it off the rack at Banana Republic. And Shaq sees this and says, do you own any suits? And he's like, nah, man, I don't. Tomorrow, come meet me tomorrow. And he meets Shaq and Shaq's personal tailor. And Shaq pays for six suits for Mike Penberthy. He was just that kind of teammate. And he just wanted Kobe Bryant to want that kind of relationship. You have to love each other. You don't have to be best friends. But I want you to want me to be sort of a big brother type to you. I want you to confide in me. I want you to ask for advice. And I really think Shaq sort of viewed this kind of Batman and Robin setup where he really liked. And Kobe just, he didn't read comic books. He didn't care about that. He just wanted to come. He wanted to play. He wanted to dominate. He wanted to continue with his goals. He wanted to work hard. And he didn't meet. I mean, there's one story I thought was really telling where J.R. Reed was briefly a Laker. He was acquired in the Glenn Rice trade. And Jerry West says to him one time, I really like the way you talk with players. Is there any way you can help maybe take Kobe under your wing? Jerry Reed says, yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Kobe, come on back in the plane. We're playing cards. Nah, man, I'm good. Hey, Kobe, we're going out for dinner, a bunch of us. Why don't you come to dinner with us? Nah, I'm good, man. Hey, Kobe, you want to go watch a movie? Nah, I'm good. And about a week later, J.R. Reed goes back to Jerry West and says, I tried. There's nothing I can do here. That was it.
Yeah. And you describe it was a dinner, a number of the players getting together, and Kobe turns him down, and then shows up at the same restaurant with a book and sits there by himself while his teammates are, you know, a few tables over.
There's a companion moment when Robert Horry and Rick Fox are out one night, and it's early, and it's two nights before a game, and they're out at like 7 o'clock, and Robert Horry's drinking a beer. And Kobe, this is two nights before a game. And Kobe says, yo, Bob, how can you be drinking before a game? The game isn't even that night. It's the next night. And they're just shoo him away. Okay, kid. All right, kid. Goodbye. Like, he just didn't get it. He wanted so badly to be great that I think he missed some of the nuances that also make you enjoy the ride a little bit.
We're talking with Jeff Perlman, author of Three Ring Circus. How did the rape allegation from Colorado affect Kobe's relationship with his teammates?
Oh man, that whole season was a disaster. It's 03-04. But number one, if we're just being blunt, he threw Shaquille O'Neal under the bus in an interview with detectives, and that never went over well and never totally vanished, where he basically said along the lines of, why, when Shaq pays off a woman to keep her quiet, nothing comes out of it. Like, why is that? How is that fair? It was this really ugly thing that got back to the other players. It was interesting. There's basically two ways Kobe could have played this whole thing, which is he shows up with the Lakers and he just is embraced and he seeks that warmth. And the other is he shows up at training camp and he just goes dark. And he showed up a little late to Hawaii for training camp. And he was asked immediately by reporters, are you going to confide in your teammates about any of this? And his response was a very curt, why would I? You know, at that point, he was just, he was 1 foot out the door to leave for the Clippers as a free agent after the year. He was mad at the organization. He was mad at the organization, strangely, for he was not happy with the plane, the caliber of plane they were giving him to fly back and forth to Eagle, Colorado. That definitely rubbed some people the wrong way as well. It was just a really ugly, dark period, and I don't think he was mature enough to handle it. And I think it just went very, very badly.
The case didn't end up actually being prosecuted in court, as the young woman who had alleged sexual assault decided not to pursue that, but there was a financial undisclosed settlement between Kobe and his accuser. And I think, you know, now it seems like much more would be made of that currently than was made at the time. Do you think so?
I agree. It kind of came, it went, it was a huge, huge, huge international story. And it kind of went without, with a whisper a little bit when she decided not to pursue. I interviewed the DA for the case at length. I interviewed two lead detectives at length for the book as well. They're both convinced he would have gone to jail. They were both convinced he did it. I interviewed them obviously before Kobe died, but well after the case. They were as convinced of his guilt as probably most cases they'd ever been convinced of. And for the DA in particular, who really worked to build up the case, when the woman decided not to go forward with it, which he understood, she was being harassed relentlessly. I mean, the National Enquirer was digging through her garbage. It was a nightmare. But when she backed out, he was truly devastated because he felt this was a case that was actually worth fighting.
Jeff, in closing, I want to ask you, you know, the thing that so many Laker fans have asked, was there any way to save the Shaq-Kobe Lakers, to keep the two stars together on that team and avoid the trade of Shaq to Miami? Anything that could have saved that?
No. It's funny. People say, how many titles could they have won? And I always say the number of titles they did win. There was when they lost to Detroit in the 2004 finals, after game five, the Lakers held a team function, Jerry Buss did, at a hotel nearby, and it was a closed off function. And Kobe just said to one of his teammates, he said, I am never playing with that guy again. And that was it. It was over.
Wow. Ralph says, as someone who watched just about every dribble of the Kobe Shaq Lakers, I readily acknowledge the greatness of both superstars, but have long preferred the tough and gritty nuts and bolts role players who played with them. Derek Fisher, Rick Fox, Robert Horry, Ron Harper, A.C. Green, Horace Grant, Brian Shaw, and more. Ralph, you'll find their stories told in Three Ring Circus as well. Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the crazy years of the Lakers dynasty. Jeff Perlman, great to have you with us again, and we'll look forward to reading your book a few years down the road about this current version of the Lakers, particularly if they win the NBA title this year.
All right, I'll be there. Thank you.
All right, thanks so much. Have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next, then All Things Considered at 1.